Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our podcast project on rethinking sex education. I try each week to post some thoughts here that help us get a conversation started about creating a viable, a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality, because what we've been doing isn't working. And I do hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment. I want to thank those many who have, because at the end of this project, I'm going to turn what we learned together into a book. And so let's go ahead and begin this week's episode, which is part three, Waiting for Sex and Feeling Blue. As we've seen in the last two episodes, the conversation with our young people about waiting begins long before we talk about sex. One form that the preliminary conversation takes is teaching them that life comes with limits. We prepare for sex talks when we teach our young people that each day has only 24 hours and that each lifetime gets maybe only 80 years, and that this simple human reality imposes choices on us. Sex talks begin when we teach them that a life of character is the accumulation of a lifetime of wise choices. We teach them that a virtuous life is formed by how we make those limit-imposed choices that are required of us during the days and the hours that we get on this earth. The conversation about waiting for sexual fulfillment begins when we teach our young people about character, about waiting in general. So first, we learn to live with limits when we learn to wait. We talk to our children about waiting for sex until the time is right, while we are teaching them about life's universal limits and the choices that those limits force us to make. When we choose to play a video game in the afternoon, we're not talking about sex at that moment, but the choice to play a video game is also a choice not to do homework. Now, that certainly has a short-term appeal for a lot of young people, but as education-driven as our economy is, it doesn't do much for long-term well-being. Every day, life's limits force us to choose the kind of people we will be. Do we honor the short or do we honor the long-term in our decisions? Do we honor the short or do we honor the long-term in our lives? The conversation about waiting for sexual fulfillment begins as a conversation about choices. It begins as a conversation about the kind of lives that our choices create for us. In the 1970s, Stanford University ran a series of experiments on children. Each child was offered a choice between a small reward now or a bigger reward later. The child could choose between one marshmallow now or two if he or she could wait 15 minutes. Now, later in life, the children who could wait for the marshmallow tended toward better life outcomes. They had better SAT scores, they had higher educational achievement, they had lower percentages of body fat, and all kinds of outcomes in several areas of their lives, they had better outcomes. The conversation about waiting for sexual fulfillment really begins as a conversation about the kind of people we will be and the kind of choices we will make. It begins as 100 conversations about immediate versus deep desire. It begins as discussions about living peacefully when we need to wait for the thing that we want right now. It begins as a conversation about how we handle unmet desire. Does unmet desire consume us? Does it thwart our happiness? The conversation about delaying sexual gratification begins as 100 conversations about delaying any kind of gratification until the time is right. Before we talk about sex, we talk to our young people about how they deal with their inner drives. We all have that drive to get whatever we want, to get it whenever we want it, damn the cost. And that's where the conversation begins. It begins as chats about our cravings, about whether those cravings control us or we control them. So which makes conversations about sex really have to begin as conversations about character. They begin as we teach our young people about their own internal, mental, and emotional structures, as we train them to stand outside of their cravings and direct them. The conversation begins when we train them to handle the interior frenzied desire they have for candy or for video games or for going out to play. It begins when we equip them to see and to direct their interior drives, to be able to say, "I see you craving, but I can also stand apart from you and tell you to hush when the time is right. There will be time for you later, craving, but for now, you do not rule my internal world. For now, my focus goes elsewhere. For now, my world will not be yanked around by your frenetic need. That's how we begin the conversation with our young people. We teach them to live well with limits. We teach them that when we limit their television time and their video game time and their hanging out with friends time. We teach them to wait when we help them develop the interior psycho-emotional structures that allow them to live peacefully even when they don't get the thing that they want when they want it. We teach them that they can be content even when life restricts them. The conversation about waiting for sexual fulfillment begins as a conversation about money and ice cream and homework and exercise and time. It begins as hundreds of small conversations that are framed around the rub that every time we say yes to one thing, we are saying no to something else. It begins as 100 conversations we have with them about how every time we invite something into our lives, we push something else out. It begins as conversations about how we cannot ever fulfill all of our cravings, how feeding one simply produces another, and that to find peace and to find contentment in this state of human affairs, it's essential for a life well lived that we learned peaceableness in the midst of not having the object of our desire. In these conversations, we teach our young people what is happening while they are learning to wait for sexual fulfillment. They are learning to live with limits. They are learning not to be controlled by cravings. Second, we learn contentment when we learn to wait. A critical indicator of our well-being is how we live with unfulfillment, because life is unfulfillment. Now, thankfully, life also affords us many moments of deep fulfillment, but a life without unmet desire is not really an option. Not for the richest of us, not for the most famous of us, not for the most loved or the most attractive. A life without unmet desire is not really an option. The conversation about waiting for sexual fulfillment has to include a discussion of internal peace. Even when we ache for something, even when we feel unconstipated in some area, even when we have to leave some taste untasted, some achievement unachieved, some expectation unrealized. A well-developed character lives well with unfulfilled yearning. Until we develop internal contentedness, we will not be able to abide being alone. And life often requires we be alone. Until we develop internal contentedness, even when we are with someone, we don't really live well. Because real-life people always experience seasons of romantic or sexual isolation. Without internal contentedness, we can't abide ever being unhealthy, or growing aged, or becoming handicapped. We can't be happy when duty or commitment limits our freedom. We can't ever handle being poor. We can't abide others tasting a pleasure that we cannot taste. The traditional wedding vows spoke of abiding with one another in sickness and in health, in good times and in bad, when we're rich and when we're poor. Internal contentedness is that bedrock place within us that enables us to fulfill those vows, because inevitably there will be times of sickness and times that are bad and times when we are poor. And we find this internal peace inside that allows us to be content even when our external circumstances are disappointing. The capacity for internal contentedness, this is critical for living well. Paul, who wrote many of the Christian scriptures, spoke of this internal capacity for contentedness. He said something along the lines of, I've been poor and I've had plenty. I've been hungry, I've been well fed. I've been befriended and appreciated, and I've been detested and beaten. And I've learned something along the way. I've learned that there is an internal place of contentedness that transcends any external circumstance in my life. Our hunger for sexual fulfillment goes about as deep as any hunger goes. Unfulfilled sexuality touches us as deeply as we get touched. So waiting for sexual fulfillment is an exercise in aching. Waiting for sexual fulfillment is an exercise in restlessness. but living patiently in the tension of sexual unfulfillment. This is about the best process there is for turning inner ache into inner quiet. It's about the best process there is for turning inner restlessness into inner restfulness. There really is no such thing as fully consummate joy. We are always in some way frustrated. Even when we have a loving sexual partner, there is some way in which we always sleep alone. Human sexuality is just too wide and too deep and too encompassing ever to be fully satisfied, no matter how much intercourse we have. Unfulfilled desire just is. It's built right into the human condition. And waiting for sexual fulfillment works contentedness and peacefulness into that deep part within our soul. Waiting for sexual fulfillment is a developmental process, the result of which is the internal infrastructure to be able to be happy irrespective of our external circumstances, which is good since we can't control our external circumstances anyway. When we find peace in the midst of incompleteness, we are living in the human condition as the human condition really is, because our lives just are always populated by seasons of unconsummation. Life just does generate a constant stream of unmet desire and unmet expectation and all the frustrations that result. And those who learn to live these deep internal capacities, those who develop these deep internal skills while they're waiting for sexual fulfillment, find a serendipitous byproduct to their waiting. They experience fulfillment despite unrequited desire. Something happens in the waiting. We learn the art of contentment. We learn the art of internal peace. We learn to live well in life as life is. And that's an important part of the conversation, the many, many, many conversations before we ever get to the subject of sex, in which we will be teaching our young people what happens while they're waiting for sexual fulfillment. They are learning the art of internal contentedness. Third, we learn to be comfortable in our own skin when we learn to wait. Our sexual drives compel us toward other people. They drive us to seek union with others, to seek relationship and seek friendship and deep connections with other people. Our hearts are restless until we find a place for the great energy of our sexuality to go. It's a drive. It's a good drive, and it's a drive that compels us outward. Conversely, learning to wait for sexual fulfillment can serve to drive us inwardly. We often avoid waiting for sex because we experience it as loneliness. But being alone can be more than loneliness. Being alone can be a rich spiritual environment. We can turn aloneness into the environment that the saints and the sages called solitude. Loneliness is a hungry environment. Solitude is a transformative environment. Loneliness drives us to fill up some inner incompleteness. But solitude invites us to explore an internal completeness. Lonely drives us to more activity, more social engagements, more sexual encounters, more achievement, more distraction. But solitude puts us in touch with an interior fulfillment that is a bedrock stillness that we find at the deepest part of our beings. And when we are waiting for sexual fulfillment, we are being invited to this rarefied environment of solitude. Our cultural norms are so uncomfortable with loneliness that we don't understand how to press past it to find the restorative, healing, awakening, settled environment of solitude. Solitude is one of the ancient practices that helps us become comfortable in our own skin, because solitude strengthens us by awakening us to the divine center, that place of interior resource we don't usually know we can contain. When we get comfortable in our own skin, it prepares us for fruitful sexual relationships, the kind of relationships that can last a lifetime. It is not uncommon when we're looking for a partner for the sexual journey to believe that we will find the perfect person. I bet you've done that. A lot of people have done that. Some part of us knows it's an illusion, but we still think it's so. We believe that somewhere, sometime, we're going to find just the right person. And when we do, they'll have just the right personality and just the right body and just the right values. And then we'll be happy. Which, of course, sets us up for no end of vexation. Because it's an exercise in frustration to demand inner fulfillment from external sources. But we do it. Sure we do. Our search for the perfect person sets us up to expect them to be the source of internal fulfillment, which is an impossible task. But we do it, and not just with our sexual partners. We look to our families, or our jobs, or our friends, or our achievements, or our bank accounts to evoke an internal sense of peacefulness and well-being. But that just isn't how it works. The term comfortable in our own skin points us to a place of settledness that comes from within, which is really the only place we ever really get it. When our external lives go well, that's a really nice thing. But if we're paying attention, we've all experienced internal discontent even when external things are going well. Settledness is an internal state of being, not an external one. Spouses can't provide it. Children can't provide it. Sexual fulfillment can't provide it. Neither can romantic or erotic love. When we're waiting for sexual fulfillment, it is an invitation early in our lives into the transformative environment of solitude. It's an invitation to discover the interior state of settledness. Do that, and when we come to our sexual relationships, we come less driven to exact pressure on our partners. Do that, and we come into our sexual relationships less driven by the pressure that can thwart the very fulfillment that we're seeking. When we get comfortable in our own skin, when we see our own flaws and the things in our own lives that are not as we want them to be, right there in that unfulfilled state, there is within us a place of internal settled peace. And if we find it, which those who have gone before us tell us happens in this state of intentional solitude, when we find it, it enables us to extend that same acceptance and peace to our partner as they live in their own skin. Fourth, we learn to be vulnerable when we learn to wait. It's a simple truism that love makes us vulnerable. When we love someone, if they hurt, we hurt. I heard an expression once that said, a parent is only as happy as their unhappiest child. When we love someone, if they mistreat us, we hurt. When we love someone, if they go off the rails, in many ways, they take us with them. Love makes us vulnerable. As wonderful as love is, it is also a threat. And we come equipped with pretty good threat detection systems. If our ancestors didn't have good threat detectors, they got eaten. And if they got eaten, they didn't mate and they didn't have offspring, which has given us a pretty good onboard threat detection system because we carry the accumulated danger-avoiding genes of all our threat-surviving ancestors. And when we're in love, a euphoric chemical swirl tends to suppress our awareness of the threat that our partner represents. But again, our brains are really good at this stuff. Our brains don't miss the threat. From the time we begin to fall in love, we begin building up defense strategies against the threat that our partner represents. Below the level of conscious awareness, our brains are ticking away, figuring out how to control our sexual partner, or how to keep her happy so she won't leave us or hurt us, or how to insulate ourselves from him so he won't be a danger. Our go-to strategies for threat avoidance tend to cluster in some form of control or appeasing or insulating ourselves. These are the energy centers of our soul when we are not yet comfortable in our own skin. These are the coping strategies of the soul that has not yet found its way to interior peace, irrespective of external circumstances. Baked right into the sexual relationship is a threat detection system that undercuts the vitality of the relationship. And the invitation to solitude, the invitation to wait for the timing to be right for sexual fulfillment, it is an invitation to probe the inner recesses of our own souls, to find the place of peace that abides even when love is a threat, even when love touches fear below our conscious awareness, even when our partner's fears push up against our own, even when our partner's coping strategies push up against our own. Waiting is an invitation to find the inner peace that allows us to be vulnerable with the one we love. It's just a fact, love makes us vulnerable. Despite our coping strategies working overtime to avoid the fact, it just is. All our coping strategies really do is insulate us from the capacity to love deeply, because to love deeply is to be vulnerable. The invitation of waiting, the invitation of seasons of sexual unfulfillment, is an invitation to grow in an interior capacity to love deeply and genuinely and vulnerably. Fifth, we learn to be careful when we learn to wait. I talk to a lot of young people about how they practice their sexuality, and the trends are not all bad. Young people are pretty smart. They've figured out a lot about the historical moment that we're living in. They've made some really great strides adapting to it. One thing is they don't jump into committed marriages lightly. They're very careful about committing themselves to sexual relationships. Now, some of it's fear, because many grew up as children of divorce and they've seen the devastation that causes, but it's not all about fear. Many are using their waiting time wisely. They're working harder than previous generations to figure out people and to figure out their potential partners. Many young people have become avid students of relational health. They study how to make relationships work. They study the psycho-emotional wholeness that's necessary for relationships to work. They're holding back and not committing themselves prematurely. They're being cautious and they're being careful, and they're waiting longer, and they're experimenting with relational dynamics. They're exploring people and different kinds of people and different personalities, and they're giving themselves time to learn transparency and trust and to ready themselves for commitment. They're not waiting to get into bed, but they are waiting to commit themselves. And as a rule, while they're waiting, they're readying themselves, preparing themselves. One of the ways that young people are adapting to this historical moment is the trend toward group dating. A date used to be two people alone having dinner and going to a movie. The trend today is for people to go out together in groups. It's a smart strategy. Being in a group lowers the risk of entanglement before they're ready. It takes some of the pressure off a relationship. It allows things to unfold slowly enough for the psychological and emotional processes that we've looked at earlier. And since it's taking longer for young people to get established in their careers, they don't have the money for the old patterns of dating, and being cautious as they aren't ready for the commitment. So they're grouping around, getting to know people, watching, observing, talking. It's one of the things we do while we wait. They've created for themselves a new cultural norm, a kind of pre-commitment space to explore relationships. By doing groupiness instead of one-on-one-iness, they create spaces to learn about each other and to observe each other in a pressure-free, commitment-free environment. Group dating also gives them input from the community. In the old days, our families and friends researched potential sexual partners for us. This rarely happens anymore. So while they're waiting, they're creating space to research one another online, to get to observe one another in communal contexts. Look, here they are, these young people, creating new and healthy social sexual norms. While they wait, many young people are hard at work reconstructing these networks. Sixth, we develop our non-sexual relationships when we learn to wait. Another trend I've noticed with young people is their deep commitment to building broader community. In earlier times, community was built in villages, in schools, in jobs, and in neighborhoods. But in today's transient society, we have to build our community intentionally. And our young people seem to be up to the task. A rich network of non-sexual relationships meets many of the communal needs outside of romance. Having this rich network of deep, trusting, authentic friendships takes some of the pressure off of our sexual partners. Authentic community provides a natural place to talk about our love lives. It's a place where we can learn, where we can grow, where we can develop our interior lives, the kind of lives that the sexual journey demands of us. As close families become more rare, the trends are encouraging. A lot of young people are hard at work rebuilding fragmented relational networks, reconstructing community. They have to. The meta trends in our society demand it. If we don't intentionally build non-sexual community back into our lives, our sexual relationships bear an inordinately heavy load. We look to our sexual partners to meet such a broad swath of relational need that in previous times was met by our non-sexual communal relationships. So good for our young people, reconstructing their communal networks while they're waiting for sexual commitment. Now, as I said at the beginning of these three episodes on this conversation about waiting, talking to our kids about timing their sexual journeys well, that's a foundational one. And as we've seen, it's a conversation that happens in hundreds of smaller chats about character and about living with limits, about internal personal development, about the cost and the benefits of walking to the beat of a different drum. And, as we've seen, they're conversations that demand we earn our young people's trust. They have to be conversations that are bigger than rules and bigger than taboos. We have to tap into ancient wisdom and frame it in ways that our young people can access, which is a demanding process for us. But the process prepares us to have these really important conversations. Our society is experiencing a great deal of suffering because our sexual relationships aren't working. And a lot of that has to do with not talking about waiting. Because we aren't establishing the trust to have these conversations, waiting is a conversation that is going unheld, unhad. And our young people need it. So let's do the hard work. Let's prepare ourselves. Let's have that. Let's have this conversation. So again, I'd love to hear what you're thinking. Post it to the Facebook page or to the podcast blog itself. Pick up here next time.